Hello, 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 and welcome to Tease Me. This is a podcast about the intersection of golf, business, and life. And occasionally we'll drop some gems on networking and just how that makes your life better. Because knowing more than one person is actually a good thing. Hello, hello, Tease Me listeners. Thank you for joining us for another episode. You know, this season we have been focused on telling the stories of entrepreneurs who golf. And what you may not know is that our guest this month, Malik Yoba, is not just an actor who you may remember from New York Undercover. He's also an entrepreneur focused on real estate development and other entrepreneurial ventures. What I love about this story is that we can't box anyone in. We have to look at all of the different aspects and multiple streams of income. So if you're out there thinking about starting a business, my word of advice would be surround yourself with other people that are also either entrepreneurs or working on starting their business, because you need a village, you need a network, you need a tribe, and it's always helpful to have like-minded people helping you move towards a goal and you pulling each other along. Allow me to tell you about our guest. Although this Hollywood veteran offers over three decades of commitment to the arts with over 50 film credits and more than a dozen lead roles in network cable television series, he considers himself a community and youth advocate first. Born in the South Bronx and raised in Harlem, it was his debut in the Disney classic Cool Runnings and his performance as NYPD detective J.C. Williams in the groundbreaking police drama New York Undercover that catapulted Malik into the fabric of American culture. As a serial entrepreneur, the emerging real estate developer has projects in New York City and Baltimore and is currently in post-production for his educational docuseries, The Real Estate Mixtape, Volume 1, I Build New York. The series follows Malik and a cohort of youth as he navigates his first commercial real estate deal in New York City. In 2022, Malik received an honorary doctorate of humane letters from Livingstone University and has been offered the role of honorary chair of the School of Construction at Pratt University. When we think about Malik Yoba, we often think about the work that he does in front of the screen. However, in 2017, after a 10-year apprenticeship with New York City-based La Site Development, he established Yoba Development with active real estate projects in Baltimore, Maryland, and New York City, where he is merging his passions for storytelling, real estate, and youth development into a unique platform that provides young people with access to the process of real estate development. Yoba sits on numerous boards, including the Center for Social Innovation, a co-working space for social impact entrepreneurs in New York City. He also sits on the board of the Boston Arts Academy Foundation, BAA, which supports Boston's only visual and performing arts public high school. This not-for-profit provides a diverse student body the means or the tools they wouldn't normally have led them to successful academic college experience and/or professional career, while also teaching them to be actively engaged members of their community. Let's welcome our guest, Malik Yoba.
Okay, hello, hello, Tease Me listeners. Today we have a very special guest. You know him as Malik Yoba, and he is here to tell us about his life and journey into golf as well. But Malik, let's start off. Just, you know, what are you working on right now? What are you up to? And, you know, what's going on?
I'm just recovering from plastic surgery. Can you tell?
No, and they can't see you because this is audio. So
this is me and you, though. This is me and you. That's you. Right. You damn sure look transformed from when I came for the golf cart.
Sometimes people comb their hair and stuff, but go ahead.
Don't you hate that? And people act like you ain't a grown person. What am I working on? Well, I just finished a fitting for the show The Equalizer. So I'll be doing that. For a bit, but I'm working on all kinds of stuff. I'm working on Yoba Development, which is my development company, builder of people, places, and things. So I've been pretty heavy in the development space for the last 15 years, mostly quietly, and I've been talking more about it over the last few years since I produced and directed a doc series about my journey into the real estate development game. Where I took, 7 young people of color on the journey so they can be exposed to the world of the built environment. In fact, speaking of golf, one of the places we shot was at the Bridge in Bridgehampton. My son actually was a member of the Bridge Foundation's golf program. So he ended up in Syracuse on a scholarship as a result of that effort of that particular founder, Bob Rubin. And so I was covering not just development directly, but also just entrepreneurs who were developing also humans and doing things around just personal development and capacity building kind of thing. So a lot of the work I'm doing right now is at the intersection of real estate, filmmaking, and education.
And that's the focus. I love that. And I don't think enough people understand the importance of having your presence or having just people of color present in the development space. Tell me, like, what was your learning curve like getting just involved in development in general?
So after 15 years of, like, what I like to say as a a glorified apprentice, the journey started really, I mean, early. As a kid, it started with just looking at burnt out Harlem and the South Bronx where I'm from, wondering why there weren't new buildings. So in the innocence of my youth, and, you know, the naivete was like, told me I'm gonna be a billionaire so you can build. Like, those were my thoughts. Tried to do my first development deal when I was 17. I didn't know it was development. I met with the Parks Department to get a BMX track built. So I used to have to ride my bike over the George Washington Bridge to race in Braddock Park, New Jersey, or go to the Armory in Jersey City to race indoors. But there was nothing in the city. And so I thought there should be a track. And so I met with the Parks Department and proposed building one in Central Park, to which, you know, I was indulged in the conversation, but at the end, they were like, nah, it's not gonna happen. But so that's kind of where the early beginnings were. And then 2008, I had an opportunity to have a seat at the table with a good friend of mine, Dan Bythewood of La Cité Development, Black family on Long Island, been building in Harlem and in Long Island and along the East Coast. And they had acquired some property in Baltimore, some land, and invited me to have a seat at the table and to bring other partners into the mix and learn the game. And that's where it began. And then I said, the more I learn, the more I want to share. And so the real estate mixtape came out of that. Actually, while I was shooting a show called God Friended Me, and my character was a real estate developer. And this was in 2018. A year after I started my company, and I didn't really do much with it, but I knew that while shooting that show, I thought about how many people that look like us that don't have access to the process in the film business or in real estate development. And I said, I'm in both of these spaces, and you know, I have a passion for working with young people. And so I'm gonna bring three of my passions together: real estate, filmmaking, and young people. And that's where that began. And then as I began to, you know, go to different real estate conferences or have meetings or just casually run into people that happen to be in the space, I just recruited them and said, hey, I'm working on this doc. You're dope. You're doing your thing. No one knows who you are. People should know you. I'm gonna stick a camera in your face. And so that's how that was born. And then last couple of years been editing and then screening and working on partnerships with, you know, got one with Department of Education, with Department of Youth and Community Development, with Pratt School of Architecture, some HBCUs like Livingstone down in North Carolina, where recently was awarded an honorary doctorate for the work that we're doing in real estate. And just partnering with different community-based organizations that do workforce development training and opening up the aperture of our folk to our built environment. And everybody doesn't have to be a developer, but the idea is that a lot of what drives this for me is I hear too many people say, man, here they come building something we can't afford. And I'm like, who's they? And how do we become they? So that's the long and short of it.
No, thank you for sharing that. I mean, there's so many gems in that. You know, one of the things that you said that I want to go back to, you know, we're going to go back to a lot of things that you mentioned, but you mentioned you started in the South Bronx and then you moved to Harlem and that you saw a lot of dilapidated or like buildings that weren't there or like weren't being invested in. I just wonder, you know, what was the vision that got you into the space that you're in? Like, if you think about it, there's a lot of people that don't feel like they can make it. They don't feel like they can get out of their space, or they're just confined to their environment. You know, what I'm hearing is a person that transcended all of that, that didn't let their environment define them, and is now creating the environment for others to thrive in and continuously recreating. And like, should I be calling you Dr. Malik Yoba? Like, is that where we're at right now?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Should you be doctor? Should you be Dr. Malik Yoba? Is that what we're saying?
That's one of those things where, you know, it's funny because I didn't ask for that. I didn't know it was coming. I got a phone call and, you know, from a buddy in real estate, actually, who had connections to the school. And he's been a big supporter, Maurice Coleman, Bank of America. Those that listen know who he is and how much of a beast he is in that space as a Black man. And he's also in my documentary. Maurice and I go back to the 80s when I was working with the City Kids Foundation. So he knows this lifelong work I've been doing. And so, you know, he's got business with the school, and the president started talking about it and said, how about if we honor Malik? And so that's how that happened. And so, you know, Maurice likes to say, you know, Malik, you got to use that. Like, you know, they gave you that for a reason. And so I love the way it looks in front of my name. I mean, I don't have a college degree. I did not go to college. I did not matriculate in any school, even though I took courses at Parsons, at FIT, at BMCC, Borough of Manhattan Community College, and the New School, but never matriculated as a kid coming out of high school. I love learning, but I didn't necessarily always love the environment. And I love teaching. I love education. And I've, you know, sought to be as educated as I can possibly be, thanks to the streets and to YouTube.
Okay. You know,
and Google and God. Anything, what do you want? Like, right now, there's really no excuse. I mean, literally, like, one of the things I love is, like, you literally can go, like, I have, like, you know, Stanford Business School podcast or Harvard Business Review. Like, that stuff is out there. The same information these students are getting, you can get a good portion of it, right? But more importantly, I'm in the real world, being able to really sit down with mayors and land use people and council people and, you know, other people in, you know, the bureaucracies and commissioners of agencies and, you know, and presidents of schools. And I'm able to really do business and really make some stuff happen. So, you know, the whole purpose of doing the doc series specifically was to celebrate and highlight people that don't have cameras following them normally. And those are my heroes. Like, those are the people that I'm like, when I pull up, you know, like a Kurt Goodrich, who's the president of Monadnock Development Construction. It's a Black man, only Black dude I know running a white-owned firm, development firm, right? He should be celebrated. People should see that. He's from Flatbush, right? You know, and all of this work we're doing has led to a redevelopment of a public school in the South Bronx. And this is something that we're insisting upon. This is not something that the city said, oh, we should redevelop this. It's something that our team became aware of this school. I actually spoke at that school some years ago. In fact, the same year I was doing God Friended Me. Little did I know, 4 or 5 years later, I'd go back to that same school, part of the redevelopment team for it. But what I do know is the first time I went to that school, there was a picture of Paul Robeson on the wall, and the school was named after him, and none of the students knew who he was. And that's a problem. The teachers didn't know who he was. And the school is named after the man. That building is. There's 3 schools in the building. But I think it's important and that we see ourselves. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. And, you know, it's funny because I used to look at Magic. Magic was running around, you know, bringing Starbucks and TGI Fridays and 24-hour fitness, you know, to this community. And I say, like, man, one day I'm gonna be like Magic. I want to do development and leverage my celebrity. And I think I'm getting there.
Okay. Okay.
So I'm getting there.
So I think I asked a multi-level question. So we have to circle back. Inspiration out of Harlem. How did you motivate yourself to get to that very first opportunity?
Because I will run them up tangent. So yes, thank you for that. Really, it's a combination of things. It's definitely nature and nurture. I definitely was born, according to my oldest sister of the six of us, she would always say, you were just born with, you just danced to a different drummer. So I was just that kid that was, I used to get in trouble for the same shit I do now. I have the audacity to believe I could do something that, quote unquote, I had no business doing. And that could have been riding a bike down some stairs because I believed I could do it, or jumping in a pool and swimming at 4 when I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but I didn't drown, or jumping on a motorcycle for the first time, or deciding I'm going to open a restaurant, or so many things that I've done. I just do it, right? I just go toward it. And so that's part of it. I think part of it is the way we were raised. My father always talked about ownership. We grew up in low and moderate income co-ops in Harlem. So although we were not wealthy financially, we were quite rich in common sense and critical thinking skills that were developed at home. And, you know, he would say things like, build your own generator so when they turn off the power, you still have lights. Black man gotta hustle, right? Gotta own. So there was always these messages around ownership, about responsibility. If there's a crack, fill it, he would say that. So there was always this sense of you can do anything, right? Even though he was born in 1927 and, you know, lived through Jim Crow and dealt with a lot of that directly, he had some of his traumas from that and didn't always see life, and not supposed to, right? Like he used to say to me, you always look for the path of least resistance. Well, we've learned the word flow right now. It's living in flow. People use terms like law of attraction, right? My father was speaking, he wanted that for us, but at the same time, he wasn't able to manifest at that same level. So if I would claim things for my life, he'd be like, boy, you're always looking for the path of least resistance. I'm like, nah, but that's what I see. Right. And because I saw things, I follow them and then you manifest them. And so a through line in my documentary is exactly answer to the question that you ask is how do you transcend these ideas? Because that's what they are. Right. The thought that black people specifically do not deserve investing in their communities. Right. That's government policy. That was the thinking that drove redlining policy, the Federal Housing Authority Administration, or the Federal Home Loan Owners Corporation. Right. All of that federal policy that was driven by surveyors that came to our communities like, nope, black people, y'all ain't getting no insurance, you ain't getting no mortgage, you're not getting nothing. Right. So that was thinking that created policy, that created our reality. And you reverse engineer that, or not even reverse engineer that, understand what it is, which is, doesn't matter where you're from. Doesn't matter what you look like. You know, don't matter. None of it matters. The only thing that matters is which is in the first real estate you own, which is in your mind. And I tell people all the time, invest in that. Like, you go to a room in the most poverty-stricken hood anywhere. Go, how many people own real estate? Most hands will not go up. And then you say, every hand should go up because the first real estate you own is in your mind. And when you invest in that, and this whole project is about not Malik Yoba, the person you know as an actor, but Malik Yoba, the dude born in the South Bronx, raised in Harlem, who decided that this is what I was going to do. And I want to show by example that if you think a certain way and move on those thoughts, look at what your life will attract, who you'll attract, the situations, the circumstances, the resources, the information, you just have to work it, right? It's all right here, right? And then decide this is what you're going to do. It's not easy. And an entrepreneur is being an emotionalpreneur. Do you have the emotional fortitude when nothing looks like it is working? You owe this, you owe that, this person's that, but you got a vision. That's the only way to transcend, is to not stop.
So many powerful gems there, because I always talk about the vision and the fact that people can't see your vision because that's something that's uniquely placed in you. And so you can't explain things that people can't see because they can't imagine. They've never seen the things you've seen. They never experienced the things you've seen or experienced what you've experienced. And like, you know, not to bring you back to like a sad or a hard point, but, you know, in your youth, at one point you were shot. And when we think about like just how life has transformed, when you think about these experiences that set you on another path, we connected on spirituality at the golf course. And that actually wasn't the first time I met you. I had met you coincidentally at a golf outing back in the 90s, I think, at Seaview. And there were all these celebrities there for this nonprofit. I can't even tell you the name of the nonprofit, but I knew I was in a foursome with the guys from The Wire and Cat Williams. And you were there, and I think you were being honored or speaking or something. But when everything comes full circle, we're back on a golf course and you're talking about the connection of spirituality and golf. First, tell everyone, how did you get into golf? How did you start playing? The guy from the Bronx had the near-death experience that ended up being on everyone's favorite TV show, New York Undercover, because that made Black people proud, even though it was on Fox.
Well, Fox wasn't Fox then. Fox right. News didn't even exist then. I mean, so there's that. Well, back to the shot thing. So back to the thoughts become things and the power of our intentions, right? First time I had a gun put to my head, I was 12. And it was a kid named Wallace who was in and out of jail. He was a neighborhood like bully and always doing some shit. And I remember like just getting in some little thing with his cousin. He came like, nigga, I'm gonna fuck you up. And he puts a 22 to my head at 12. And I said, shoot me. Right. And so whoever that 12-year-old was, I said, shoot me. Probably because I didn't believe he would do it, but he could have also done it. But that had a lot to do with just who my father was, because he was a badass. And so he definitely didn't allow us to feel like punked by anybody. So that actually got me in a lot of trouble, because I felt like I will fight everybody. I didn't start no shit, but I wasn't going to take it. And I did study martial arts, so I was prepared. So I would always wonder what it felt like to get shot. And that manifested in my life. I also wrote my autograph when I was 13 and told my teachers I was going to be famous. They should keep it. That manifested. I also wanted to go to the Olympics in bobsled. That manifested. And then I started studying Buddhism at 16 and chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo and being turned on to the law of causality and understanding how when you invoke certain things, you can manifest. So I've been tapped into that thoughts become things for quite some time inherently. And then I learned an actual practice, right, as a kid where I could employ that. So that's that part about getting shot, right? So that was a marker for me in terms of the power of thinking. But the golf thing, I was always curious about golf. And it, as it turned out, I booked a trip to go to Puerto Rico for New Year's of 1998. And literally as soon as I booked the trip, a friend of mine called and said, how would you like to go to Puerto Rico for a golf tournament? I was like, yo, I just booked my flight. What are you talking about? They were like, nah, cancel it. We're going to fly you for free. First class, bring you there. I'm like, bro, I don't play golf. Don't worry about it. Just, you're going to be on the team. It's a scramble. What's a scramble? All right, whatever. I pull up to Dorado Beach Golf Course, the Hilton in Puerto Rico, on the ocean. And I understood something. I was like, this is why white folks kept this shit to themselves. I was like, this is incredible. My only other experience with the golf course was we used to get spring water off of the Sawmill River Parkway there was an actual spring where water came out of the ground here in New York, in Yonkers. And as kids, every Saturday or Sunday, my father would pile us into the car to go fill up the empty plastic milk gallons to get the spring water. And sometimes we would explore up past where the water came out, the little side of the mountain. And it was a golf course. And as a kid, I didn't understand how greens, putting greens could be, that surface could look like that. So this is around the time when like AstroTurf became a thing, like in football. So I remember climbing the fence, running around on the greens, and then realizing, oh shit, this is actually real. But we probably fucked up this golf course. Knowing what I know about golf. So that was the only other experience with golf. But I go to Puerto Rico's for Roberto Clemente's Sports City. So it was like a weekend of like baseball, softball tournament with a bunch of Yankees and Roberto Clemente's family. And then golf tournament. And the team I was on, there was this really nerdy dude, but he grew up playing golf and he was scratch. I didn't know what that was. Scratch. I'm like, scratch my ass. What the fuck are you talking about? Like, so this dude carried the team. I made one lucky putt from like maybe 20 feet. And we won third place. And I remember thinking, like, if this nerdy dude could play this sport, I'm gonna learn how to play. And we won. So I had that like little bit of wind beneath my wings. And then I came back to New York and it's like winter. So I discover there's a golf range in Chelsea Piers. Now, we had just shot New York Undercover at 85 10th Avenue, which is on 15th, between 15th and 16th, between 10th and the West Side Highway. So in that building, we could see Chelsea Piers be built and we saw the nets go up. I didn't know anything about that. And I discovered, wait a minute, all these years I've been shooting this show across the street from a damn driving range. So I go to that driving range. I don't know if you ever met this guy, Will. He was like the one black
guy. Yeah, yeah. Will gave me my first golf job.
Will gave me my first golf lesson.
Okay.
So I go to Chelsea Piers and I don't know. I just say, give me some clubs. And I grab like a 7-iron and a driver and something else. And I'm out there and I'm whacking away at the driver. And Will, being who he is, sees me. Oh, that's the dude from New York on the cover. So I got to clown him because he's in my world now. What are you doing? He's like, what are you doing with that? I said, I'm obviously trying to hit the ball. He was like, man, that's the hardest club in the bag to hit. Come here, let me show you something. And he takes me in the back. And he takes me in like little video area and he says, pick a player. And I didn't really know anybody. I saw Tiger Woods had just won the Masters, I think that same year, the year before, whatever it was. And I picked Davis Love because I liked his name. It's like, oh, that's a cool name, Davis Love. So he splits the screen and he puts some balls down. He goes, hit the ball. And as I'm swinging, he goes, you know what? Your swing is about 50% better than most people when they start. And I was like, really? He goes, let me show you something. So he splits the screen, he puts Davis Love's swing up to mine. And he begins to show me the mechanics. And I'm a visual learner. So it's kind of easy for me to like mimic. And that was my first lesson. And literally within 18 months of that first lesson, I broke 190 and 80 within 18 months. The second person to give me, well, I shouldn't say second person, because there were a couple other people. Like after that first lesson, I was like, yo, as most people say, it gets addictive once you hit that first ball. And then you realize like, wait, there's all these mechanics and I suck, but then I'm good, but then I suck. And that was a good shot, but then I suck. So all that kind of crazy stuff. But then I got obsessed and I went to Centennial upstate New York to like a golf academy. And then that was like, so January, February, March. And then March, I was shooting Or I might have, like, I think I got invited from the Puerto Rico tournament to, like, another one somewhere, maybe in the Bahamas or something. And then while I'm in the Bahamas, and so there's that, right? So I'm like, well, I just played in Puerto Rico. Now I'm at the Atlantis in the Bahamas. And Serena and Venus were just starting out. And it was a golf and tennis tournament. So they were there. And then this woman says, oh, what are you doing next? I said, I'm going to New Orleans. I got to shoot a pilot. And she goes, oh, I live on a golf course in New Orleans. So when you come, why don't you call me? So I go to New Orleans, and she gave her contractor the day off so he could take me to play. And then every golf course I went to, I met someone else who was like, oh, let me bring you here. So within the first 8 months, I played at 60 different courses in 5 states and 2 countries. And then it was just kind of off to the races. And in that time, or within the first, so by 99, I remember I was playing, yeah, within the first year, I was playing down in Isleworth. And what's his name? Who won the US Open? And then died in a plane crash. What's his name? Payne Stewart. 1999, Payne Stewart. So I'm playing at Isleworth in front of Tiger and Payne Stewart. And Shaq lived there at the time. D. Brown, who played for the Celtics, lived there at the time. Tiger lived there. Payne lived there. So we're playing. And I finish my round and I go to the range to practice. And I'm shanking wedges. And Payne comes up to me, and I just watched this dude win the US Open. And he was a fan of New York on the cover. And he goes, oh, you're that guy from that show. And I'm like, oh shit, that's dude. Like, really? He goes, yeah. He says, looks at my grip. He goes, first of all, I forgot what it was. It might have been too open or too closed. I don't remember. But he adjusted my grip. He's like, just hit these balls. He goes, this is a great club to work with, because all the backspin, he explained the physics of it to me. And he said, just have fun. Don't keep score. So just hit these balls nice and light, have just easy swing. And so I took that advice and I stopped keeping score. And then I went out one day and I played with this old couple back in New York at Split Rock in the Bronx. And when you hit fairway green, you kind of know what's going on. And like, did you two put? I'm like, wow. And I forgot what I was on the front. I think it was like 32, whatever it was. I shot a 77 that day. It might have been like 44, 33 or something like that, whatever it was. And the couple I was playing with, they were keeping score. So the guy would ask, what'd you get? And I tell him, whatever. Or he would just tally it. And then I think it was right as we were getting to 18, he told me, and he goes, look at this. And it was a 77. And I broke, that was the first time I broke 80.
Wow.
And I always credit that with Payne Stewart. But it happened within the first 18 months.
Wow.
But I don't play enough to go out there right now and shoot 77. But I've shot in the 70s a few times. But, you know, I kind of leveled out at about a 9, 10 handicap, right around 80, 81 in there somewhere, 82, when I was playing a lot. So,
yeah. So wait, you have to tell us also. So, you know, we talk about the technical aspects of the game and improving our score, but the things that you're learning about yourself on the course, like, what was golf telling you about yourself? Because I focus a lot on helping people identify and become more self-aware and really understand their strengths and then understand other people while they're on the course. So tell us like what your journey has been like, even that fact that you don't play as much, but you know what you're capable of and just the humility that provides.
That part, the humility. I think golf don't give a damn about you. And there's so many metaphors. If that ball don't move till you move it, it's like your life. Yeah. And if you don't do what you're supposed to do, you are not going to get the results you want. there's so many metaphors about alignment. And for me, like, we talked about spirituality when we met. And so I remember when my game got to a point where your instincts and your intuition kind of can inform you, right? When you first start, you're so focused on, okay, am I gripping too tight? Is it too loose? Is my follow through? Did I turn my shoulders, my hips, and my, you know, hips motivate to turn toward the ball and the direction of the swing? And am I on the right plane? All that stuff, right? The club face open on impact, all that stuff. So you have to learn all that stuff consciously until it becomes unconscious. And then now you have it, right? And so now you are, you know, and I literally could see the hole in LA where I was playing when this hit me. Hole number 6, it's a par 4, dog leg left. If you land on the right side of the fairway, you have an uphill side hill lie. And as you know, if you have an uphill side lies a right player, a right-handed player, if you swing properly along the proper plane, right, the ball's is going to tend to go left, right? And so you got to either come inside, hit it straight or whatever, right? And then you know, like, okay, I'm 160 yards, but I'm in a flyer lie, so that might take it 170, whatever it might be. And it's downhill, so I might get 175, right? The green is below the fairway at that point. So you have all that, the physics in your head, and you know. And then you say, you walk up to the ball, and you go, I know I'm supposed to go a little inside on takeaway, but I'm going to go just keep it straight and hope I can make it do what it's supposed to do. And you fail. And you fail and you fail and you fail. And I remember the day I said to myself, when I approach the ball, given that I've studied all that I've studied and I have all this critical, these, you know, information, I'm going to listen to that voice that says, step back, make sure you're aligned, don't try to finesse it, hit the proper, like all those things, right? That can tell you, step up, you go. Especially when you play a lot, at least for me, that sense of distance gets really honed in. You go, step, it's about 153 yards, it's 172, and you like within a yard, right? If you look at the viewfinder. And I remember the moment that I said on that golf course where I said, like, stop trying to will it. Listen to what your spirit is telling you to do. And if you listen to your spirit and if you are aligned, you will get the results. And I can tell you, I don't know how many like strokes I dropped from my game once I started doing that, that I stopped trying to will it. I stopped trying to like manipulate it. I just said, if you are aligned with your purpose and if you follow through, you will get to where you're trying to get to.
That's a whole sermon. That's a whole sermon. Yeah. I don't think people pay attention to like the synergies of golf and life, or just the way in which the same terminology and the way we speak about golf is the way we speak about life. Like, cannot will yourself into, I mean, maybe speak positive things, but you need to act on it and you need to take the right action. And you know what the right action is most of the time, but then we second guess our judgment and our, you know, whatever our initiative is. Like, whatever we're told, we have intuition. We know what the initiative is. We know what we need to do. And then we totally do something else. And it's like, well, who, why? Right. Why are we doing that? And what I love about like your story and just the overall like spirituality aspect of it, that aha moment happened in a space where you can go back to that day in time. Do you remember which course that was?
Franklin. I'm sorry, Roosevelt in Los Feliz Park, the sixth hole.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then when you think about like, as we're going through life, going back to those pivotal moments, those anchor moments that take us back. I think other things that people are interested in hearing, you know, on this podcast in general, you know, if you're not getting out to play golf as much and you're working on different screenplays or acting, what is it that keeps you motivated to go back to acting? It's such a, well, from the outside looking in, it looks like such a thankless, you know, just grind. You're constantly competing and you're constantly trying to get paid what you deserve. And you're constantly, you know, reading scripts. I mean, I'm just
Were you at my lunch today? Were you at my lunch? Where were you? You spying on me, girl. You were spying on me.
But talk to us. Like, what keeps you going back to it? I know passion can do that, but why persevere?
I appreciate that question. I mean, that's very, very intuitive of you, young lady, because I'm doing an Equalizer right now, and I was meeting with a producer friend that's on the show, he and I hadn't seen each other in maybe 15 years, but he's one of my favorite people, and we used to play a lot of golf together, actually. In fact, so here's a funny story. So it's going to be a little long-winded, but this is one of the reasons that keeps me going. So, where do I start the story? So 2000 or so, I'm 99. So I finished New York Undercover, and I did a show right after that was short-lived called Trinity. And then I get an audition for a show called Bull. It's about Wall Street. And I do my audition, and I'm leaving. This producer runs behind me, this black dude, Eric Lonneville. And he says, "Hey man, I've always wanted to work with you, but I hear you're difficult. What do you have to say for yourself?" I said, "Rosa Parks." He goes, "What? Explain." I said, "Well," he was referring to when my partner, Michael DiLorenzo, and I walked off on the show, New York Undercover, because we were treated like shit. And going into the third season, we fought for basic human rights, like high food truck, security on set. This is Harlem before the gentrification. Like, no place to get, just basic amenities that any other production of that level would get. We weren't getting it. So we were vilified in the public. It was made ungrateful. They asked for more money. It wasn't about that. It was about basic fucking respect. So when this dude says that to me, and I'm like, "Rosa Parks." And I was like, "Bro, we weren't sitting in the back of the bus anymore. We used to call New York Undercover the little ghetto show that could. Yeah, a nigga in Puerto Rican, watermelon, frying chicken, a roast con pollo, anything goes, it's a little ghetto show." That was our fucking little song on set. Okay, well, everybody was loving us. We weren't getting the love. So, finish that show. I do this audition. I'm leaving. Eric approaches me. I tell him Rosa Parks, and he has to explain. And I tell him, "Bro, we were not taking shorts. We were looking for respect." He was like, "Oh, because, you know, the other thing that happened is I remember seeing you at Malibu Country Club, and you were the only other black dude there, and I wanted to talk to you, and you ignored me at the turn." Like, and I was like, "Bro, like, yo, I just got stung by a bee." Like, and I remember the day that he was talking about, and I didn't want to talk to anybody. I was trying to go get first aid. So it was a funny little anecdote. So cut to, I get an offer for Equalizer last week, and I open the script. They have the list of all the producers. And I say, "Oh shit, Eric's on there." So I call Eric up and I'm like, "Bro, you're in town?" So we had lunch today. And very happy to see him. And I love telling that story because the man has never changed. And we were saying the exact same thing. I said, "You know, this is almost like I'm like semi-retired, you know, because of everything you just said, the grind of it, the groundhog day of it, you know, the folks not wanting to pay you, you might like all of the things. And I am a storyteller. I don't have to tell stories as an actor. I can tell them through real estate. I can tell them as a director. I've got a book coming out. I've got I write, you know, TV. I've written a pilot. There's other things I can do that I have to do, really. Like, it's these gifts that I've been given, I have to use them. And I feel really, really passionate about that. So what keeps me going is the fact that I feel like I haven't done anything yet. That's really, except this year, 2021 to 2022, in the year after I had heart surgery. I don't know if I told you this. I think I did mention to you that when I was on the day I met you at the golf course, I was actually feeling chest pain. I didn't know that it was like blocked arteries and it was lactic acid, but it was actually that. And I had surgery maybe a month after I met you. And we had it August 19th, 2021. And then recovery, a lot of walking, just getting back on it. Didn't play golf for the first time in November of 2021, actually in Dubai, which was perfect to be playing in November if I'm not like being in New York. But, and that was the first time I swung clubs and was like, oh, I can actually do this again. And, it, you know, I was feeling weak. I definitely was not hitting that ball the way I used to hit it as far. But I began during that time, I had just written and directed a short film. So I was in the middle of editing that. I was in the middle of editing my doc series. And then in from then to now, so say like October, November, written a pilot, finished my book proposal, which is about five chapters, and then editing my doc series, like I said, the pilot, all these deals that I mentioned around the real estate stuff I'm doing. That level of productivity, I've never had that much output in one less than a calendar year in my life. And it's all self-directed. It's all my voice, the things I care about. It's not me playing a character. So when an offer like Equalizer shows up, or a film I did in Spain a couple of months ago, or just did a show called East New York here, or Last OG. Well, I did Last OG right before surgery. But when things happen like that, that are asking for my acting talents, I can be motivated to do them because they come in the form of an offer. And someone is saying, I want you for this, as opposed to the hundreds, like literally in that same time period, I might've gotten 100 auditions, literally, and got zero, right? Some I put myself in the mix for because it's like A-list talent, directors, writers, actors that I want to work with. I'll be like, all right, this is a character I haven't played, director I haven't worked with. This story is dope. But what's been interesting, back to the spirit side of these things and flow, the flow in my life is happening around all the things that I've created, because I'm honoring those gifts that God has given me, these other gifts that I've been able to touch occasionally, but not really nurture and bring to the fore. Like, if you would have said to me, Malik, next year you're going to write a book proposal and a pilot, I would have been like, yeah, I was writing both at the same time. And it's bananas to me, and editing and working and screen. And once I started screening my doc in December of 2021, around this country, and mostly the East Coast, from Florida to Connecticut. I have a fellowship with Pratt School of Architecture. I don't have a college degree, and I'm teaching on a college level at Pratt, right? And those bringing those students into real estate, real deal opportunities, right? Just the fact that, you know, just these partnerships, like, the scripture, your gifts will make room for you, like, is so apparent. So sitting with Eric today, talking about all those things you just mentioned, the grind of Hollywood and what that could feel like, what can keep me motivated is if I feel I'm honored and I'm working with people that I have love for, and it's a story I haven't told. but I'm not motivated necessarily to be on someone else's set for 12 hours or 16 hours, being a part of their vision, a part of their dream, because my dream has been realized, right, over and over and over and over again as an actor. Like, can we make more money? Can you do bigger films, smaller? We can do all that shit. But guess what? I've done it. And there's so much more that I want to do. So that's really how I do it. And it's so funny you ask that, because I was telling Eric, like, I'm semi-retired. You know, I'm 100% retired from bullshit.
Yeah, I don't even want to subscribe to that chapter of life. But before, you know, one of the things I know we have, you know, we're kind of coming to the end of the podcast, but what I want to ask, I can't miss this opportunity. I would be remiss not to mention it. And it's kind of like a low-key PSA, you know, heart health. Like, I don't think it's something we talk about in our community. And just like knowing what you know now and having been through what you've been through, for the people listening, like, what would you share?
Go get your scans. I don't care. I would share, be super vigilant around your own health. You are your best advocate for your health. That when 70% of the people that have heart attacks or heart disease, when they go for their normal yearly checkup, that cholesterol reading can read as normal, within the normal range. And so there are deeper tests and deeper exploration that you have to do to make sure that that blood test is not sufficient. Because for me, I've been getting normal, oh, it's fine. But what I now know is that if I go into a hospital or a doctor's office and they say, what is the health of your family? And I say, well, both my parents had quadruple bypass, which is true. In their 60s or their 70s, they had it. And here I am at 50, at the time I was 53, right? You could never in a million years, soul cycle four times a week, working on my trainer three times a week, like on it for decades, like not thinking I was ahead of it. Well, my father never worked out. My mother never worked out. I don't eat crazy. But that genetic gift that I got was accelerated by poultry. Who knew? Right. I didn't know that if from my particular biological makeup, that was not good. Even if it was lean protein, like that in the form of flesh, that was actually not good. And same with red meat. So I would suggest that people make sure that beyond the EKGs, the stress tests, the blood tests, that you insist on a scan, a CT scan, so they can literally go inside and see where you are. Even if they say, well, you're too young, because if I would have done that at 40, 45, 10 years prior, I would not have been at 90% blockage at 53 in four arteries, right? So that's what I would advocate for. The upside is obviously knowing your status and what's what, but it's a motivator like a motherfucker, in case you can't tell, because like, it's like,
Yeah. And I mean, and it kind of also leads us to understanding, like, we have a finite amount of time here on this earth. So let's get it all. Let's get everything done that we can. And let's use all our time. So I often hear people say, like, oh, I don't know how you're motivated to do so much. Well, what if tomorrow wasn't promised? How I can't take these ideas with me. And it's not right.
Yeah. I don't even know if it's like, if people say, like, people ask that question, like, how have you changed? Is it motivation? I've always carried this chip on my shoulder. Like, oh, this guy's an actor. I'm like, you read my bio. That ain't an actor's bio.
No.
There's a whole bunch of stuff in there. And that's just me living life. And most, 99% of that's before my surgery.
Yeah.
Right? That's just me like, okay, I can do this and I can do that and I can do this. Like, I'm gonna do it. But now it's another level.
Yeah, for y'all that are listening, you don't know, Malik sent me a 4-page bio. I mean, he's like saved the world. He's an advocate. He's social justice, doing all of the things that, you know, you want to see people doing in the community, but don't do enough of. And so in one person, we're seeing a manifestation of and a level of giving that we don't often see. Imagine if every person gave back in the way that you you have with these four pages. Y'all might not see the four page bio though.
Well, it's a kind of annoying for me too, because it's one of those things that like you don't realize all the things you've done, but you're glad you documented it. Because like, even, you know, I've got a researcher and a grant writer working with me on the development side, just doing some stuff, and I gave him like what I call just a scorecard from December to now. It's bananas. Yeah. And I'm like, wow, these milestones just in the last 9-10 months. And it's not about money, right? Because frankly, I've never done anything for money, right? Like, well, that's not entirely true. Every now and again, something will come along, you'll be like, how much are they paying? All right, I'm gonna show up, I'm gonna go do that. But I'm not motivated. I don't wake up going, well, what am I gonna do to make money? I go, what am I doing that is honoring my gifts? What am I doing that's honoring my passion? So Mark Cuban recently talked to, you know, say to people, you know, it's a little misleading to tell people to follow their passion, follow what you're good at. But I know a whole bunch of people who are good at stuff and they make a lot of money doing it, but they're not passionate about it and they hate it. Mm-hmm. So if you can find your way to some kind of middle ground, I feel fortunate that I just was naturally passionate about helping people. I was naturally passionate about like I'm the dude who, and it was actually fun. We did this, a friend of mine was a cop, Edwin Raymond, who you may know from a film called Crime and Punishment. And if you haven't seen it, please do, because Edwin's, he was born on Marcus Garvey's birthday and he lives like that. He's a Haitian dude, immigrant parents, grew up dirt poor, became a police officer, and actually is part of a group of cops that sued NYPD for targeting Black people with the Stop and Frisk program. And so he ran up a lot of opposition. He was ultimately promoted twice, captain and lieutenant. But he's also gotten a lot of backlash and death threats and all kinds of crazy shit. I heard him on a podcast that my boy Teray was doing. And I was like, who is this Negro fighting that fight from inside the system? I need to meet him. So we became quick friends. Introduced him to Michael K. Williams, and we were all working on a version of a, he's doing a book, but his life is a series. So that should be coming at some point as well. A different type of cop show for sure. But we're driving down the street the other day and a dude in an unmarked car, and a guy throws his carton of food out the window. You know, those people that do that. Like, I, for the life of me, I, and so, because when I'm in my car, dude doesn't realize it's a cop car. So I'm like, I hate that. And it was like, so do I. I was like, yo, let's go get him. So he like turns the siren on.
Like New York undercover for real, again.
And we pull up. I mean, he's officially working, right? Because he does like a community, I forget his exact title. So and we are at a red light, so we ain't really pull the guy over, but the light was red. The guys are so shook. The driver pulled, so my window goes down. So he goes, what? Wait, aren't you? But Edwin's in uniform, in a real cop car. And I'm like, yo, yeah, I am that guy. And your man's littering. And the dude that actually threw it out the window, if you could have seen the look on his face, he could not put it together. What? Am I getting arrested? But why are you here? But that's the real cop. And am I in trouble? And I'm so sorry. But that's us. We do gooders, man. I'm like, bro, this is your city. What are you doing? Don't do that.
So, I bet you he won't do it again. I bet you he learned his lesson.
I think he might have.
So wait, I have to end on one thing. What was your favorite golf course or favorite golf memory?
Oh, man. Played so many. Well, one of my, well, I'd say Puerto Rico, because that's where I started. So that's always a special memory, playing at Dorado Beach. Valderrama in Spain. Mm-hmm. They've done Ryder Cup there a couple of times. I literally went to go watch Tiger Woods play in the American Express tournament in Spain back in like 99. And being able, this is Tiger in 99, so you know what that is. So being able to be with his team, his, you know, his publicist, my man Don Wallace, brother, who was a director of PGA Tour at the time. I don't know if Don's still doing that job. So that front row access to watching greatness. And then he hit some magical shots. And he had this one shot where he hit the ball right at a fairway into some trees, canopy of trees, but there was this one opening at the top. And I think it was like, I was at 8-iron or whatever it was. He was able to loft it up out onto the green. And the next day I had the same shot. I played that course and I hit that damn shot. I was like, I saw Tiger do this yesterday. I'm going to hit that ball through the trees. I don't know if I went to the green, but I definitely got it through the trees. So that was one of them. And that course, the bunkers are literally pulverized white marble, not even sand. Wow. So they're bright, bright, bright. You never see any of the grounds crew. There are tunnels underneath the course because they don't want anyone to ever see the work. And the clubhouse is like a museum, like ancient clubs from like the 1600, whatever the golf was invented 500 years ago. Whatever it was, that's pretty spectacular, that course. There's been others, but that one was pretty special. And there's others in a little south of that, in Almanara, where you can see the Rock of Gibraltar in the Mediterranean. That was
Cool. Okay, you've given us and you've given the listener something to strive for, to try to hit and through some trees. My favorite course? If I say Van Cortlandt, is that corny?
Is that your favorite course?
I love it because it's the first public course founded in 1895. And it's like it's like the people's course.
Yeah. That's when my son, they used to play there sometime at school when he was still at Eagle Academy. How often do you get out there?
I try to get out maybe once a month to that course. I mean, I'm playing some other courses.
Let's try to get out. We said this, if I can't do your thing, but if it's not cold, let's go play.
Absolutely. So let's end the podcast here. Thank everyone for listening. And, you know, if you want to join us at Van Cortlandt, I mean, I've played some really amazing courses, but there's something unique about a course that has character and people that are characters. And you feel like it's like a home course, but it's like your homeboy course. So it's fun. And that's what I love.
How did you start playing?
Oh, me. So the story of my golf journey, I needed one credit to graduate from college. And they were offering it. So I took it at LIU CW Post. Okay. That's how I got introduced to the game. It took a longer time to start playing, but the journey into the game or just learning about it started in college.
And then when did you realize you loved it?
When I figured out I couldn't get better at it. Like I just kept, every time I was good and then I was bad. And I don't feel like I fail often, but golf was a sport that kept humbling me. Like, one day I'm good, the next day I'm not. And so I think that was around the time that I fell in love with it. Like, it's such a humbling, grounding sport.
Where do you feel your game is now?
It's on just enjoying it. I'm the kind of person that doesn't care about keeping score, but just enjoys the people that I'm out there with. So, you know, for all of the listeners, if you ever play with me, you know that the goal is to just have a really good time on course.
That's a great, you know, I think that's a great goal. Especially for men with egos, because if you played sports in the past, golf don't give a damn about you, and don't think you're gonna pull up here and be good right away. You're gonna get lucky a couple of times, but you ain't gonna be good. Yeah.
So we're gonna end the podcast right there. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you on course soon.
Great to see you, and I'll see you soon.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of Tease Me. What I loved about the conversation is that everything is grounded in our spirituality. And when we tie golf to the work that we do and we tie golf to our experiences, it often brings us to the same insights. You got to keep on trying. You have to keep on believing, and you have to do what your body's telling you to do. So you can't just will something to be. You have to actually put some effort into it. I also love the fact that when we think about development, we don't always look at the other aspects of it, developing a community, developing the youth, developing the next generation, developing content that will last and transcend our lifetime. Think about it. If you're creating, writing, producing, these artifacts will live on way beyond our years. So as you're thinking about what you want to get into and you're thinking about your entrepreneurial journey, think about what gives you joy, or at least start there. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all formula. Sometimes it's the art of being in the right place at the right time, but I also believe in Malcolm Gladwell's outliers, people that have been doing something they're passionate about over and over again. Eventually, those 10,000 hours and opportunity will intersect. And so the million-dollar question is, will you be ready when the opportunity presents itself? So you also know that this is the last season of Tease Me, and we have two more episodes to go. So I look forward to you tuning in, and thanks for joining us on another episode of Tease Me.